content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, The Mississippi is Losing Its Fight with the Ocean by Nancy Walecki. The mouth of the Mississippi River is an arena for a kind of wrestling match. In one corner of the ring is the salt water of the Gulf of Mexico, and in the other, the river's fresh water. The two shove against each other, and usually the Mississippi flows with enough force to keep the salt water out. But this year's drought, currently affecting 40% of the continental United States, sapped the Mississippi of water pressure, and a wedge of salt water began muscling its way upstream along the riverbed this summer. It's already corrupted the drinking water in several towns in southeast Louisiana and could reach New Orleans around late November. The ocean is winning. Whatever the climate brings in a year, the Mississippi River keeps the score. This year's saltwater intrusion is the integration of all these environmental events that have happened throughout the Great Plains, throughout the Ohio Valley, throughout parts of the Mountain West, Matthew Hyatt, a hydrologist at Louisiana State University, told me. Landslide droughts lower the river's water levels, and rising sea levels on the ocean side pushes saltwater in. Those who study the Mississippi agree that this year's saltwater intrusion is a particularly dramatic example of what may become a more frequent feature of the dry season. This is not a one-off or a once-in-a-hundred-years thing, William McNally, hydraulic engineering professor emeritus at Mississippi State University, told me. It's something we're going to be seeing rather often. This isn't the first time that it's happened. During the Dust Bowl, New Orleans drinking water had a salt concentration 55% above current federal guidelines. And in 1988, a year so hot and dry that about 30% of the nation's corn crop failed and wildfires raged in Yellowstone for months, a wedge of seawater stopped just short of the water intake plant for the eastern bank of Orleans Parish. In the past few decades, salt water has traveled far enough upriver that the United States Army Corps of Engineers built semi-temporary underwater earthen dams, or sills, four different times to stop it, in 1988, 1999, 2012, and last year. This year and 2022 mark the first consecutive times the Army has had to do so. Human activity is also directly clearing the path for salt water. Throughout the Mississippi's history, engineers have lowered its southernmost riverbed to accommodate the ships that fuel the region's economy. The Army Corps of Engineers last lowered the channel in 1987 to 45 feet below the waterline and has begun deepening it to 50. Any drop essentially provides more space for salt water to move in when the water levels are low, Hyatt told me. These compounding factors, lowering the water's navigational depth, sea level rise, and changing waterfall patterns, are a formula for more frequent saltwater intrusion, he said. In general, you can think of the Mississippi like a stock portfolio. John Sabo, the director of Tulane University's Bi Water Research Institute, told me. Rain in Ohio can cancel out drought in Minnesota, for instance, but when everything is withering, the river dips and peters. The Mississippi's flow patterns are also becoming more volatile, McAnally, the MSU professor, told me. A statistically predictable pattern of rain runoff and river discharge used to design infrastructure for 100-year floods, for instance, has become a statistically unpredictable pattern of dry spells and wet spells, he said. This type of saltwater wedge is, in some sense, an affliction particular to the Mississippi River. Even Mobile Bay Estuary, 150 miles, east, doesn't experience this degree of intrusion, McAnally told me. Tides can make the difference. In many estuaries, tidal fluctuations churn salt water and fresh water like syrup and ice in a slushy machine, discouraging the separation that a wedge requires. The Mississippi estuary, comparatively, is calm enough that the denser salt water can settle and move upriver. The underwater dams that the Army Corps builds work by halting the salt water flow on the river bottom, said McAnally, who evaluated the efficacy of the 1988 SIL as the chief of the Corps' estuary division. The Corps also built a SIL when the intrusion began this summer, but in late September, the seawater overtopped it. At some point, the ocean gets high enough that SILs don't work anymore, Sabo said, and we might be there. As the salt moves up the river, communities who get their drinking water from the river have to drink bottled water, pipe fresh water in from elsewhere, or run desalination systems. Keith Hinckley, the president of Plaquemines Parish, where the salt water has been since June, told reporters he hopes to install permanent desalination systems in the region, an energy-intensive and expensive proposition, but a long-lasting fix. Tyler Antrop, a visiting professor of urban planning at Tulane, says it might make sense to build a water treatment plant further upriver, large enough to accommodate multiple towns. Over time, saltwater intrusion could affect communities outside the river's immediate vicinity. If saltwater flows into the Mississippi more regularly and stays for longer stretches, eventually it leaches into the groundwater. Right now, this type of knock-on effect of sea level rise is a greater worry in places such as Florida and Texas. But in Louisiana, too, that could be something we deal with in the future, Sabo told me. And water does not move alone. If anything settles into that salt wedge, it's going to move upstream until the currents are too weak to propel it, McAnally said, leaving deposits of sediment. This could create problems in the spring when the Mississippi runs high and moves that dirt into the navigation channel and interrupt shipping. That would take what is normally a large dredging burden and turn it into impossible, he told me. If salt water keeps returning, too, the lower Mississippi could begin to fundamentally change. There's ramifications on coastal fisheries. There's ramifications on transportation. There's ramifications on for how we build infrastructure, Sabo said, because salt water can corrode pipes and send heavy metals into the water supply. The southern part of the Mississippi is a balancing act of interests. Shipping, farming, fishing, tourism, and the infrastructure to protect it all from hurricanes and salt water. When we deal with one, we affect the other, McAnally said. So what we need is to take a systems view of the whole thing. If the salt water returns often enough, far enough up the river, it could change the most basic way a city perceives itself, too. If we're focusing on where fresh water meets salt water, it means New Orleans and maybe beyond, we become a truly marine coastal town city, Sabo told me. This year, at least, Hyatt believes that the salt water will likely be gone by spring, when snow melts in the upper Midwest and sends a pulse of fresh water all the way to Louisiana. The state has long been at the center of the Mississippi's fight with the Gulf, catching blows from hurricanes, flood, and salt water, and habitable because of the engineering solutions that mitigate these dangers. But for this year's particular saltwater problem, the only thing that is going to fix this is rain, Hyatt said, and lots of it. Next, Your Sweaters Are Garbage by Amanda Mall. In much of the United States, you can already feel it. There's a hint of chill in the night air. The morning light looks somehow more golden. The pumpkin spice latte has finished its annual transit across the cosmos and returned to its home at your local Starbucks. Sweater weather approaches. Cooler temperatures bring rich textures and many layering opportunities. What this time of year no longer brings to most people, though, is amazing new sweaters, or even good ones. With apologies for describing a tweet, the comedian Ellery Smith made much the same point a few weeks ago on this platform, on the platform formerly known as Twitter. With side-by-side photos of Billy Crystal wearing an ivory cable-knit fisherman sweater in 1989's When Harry Met Sally, and the actor Ben Schwartz recreating the image in a similar outfit, Smith sounded an alarm. The quality of sweaters has declined so greatly in the last 20 years that I think it genuinely necessitates a national conversation. Her tweet racked up a couple of hundred thousand likes because she's exactly right. So let's have that conversation. The phenomenon that Smith is alluding to is clear from the photos, even if you've never before had a single thought about the state of American knitwear. Crystal's sweater is timeless and lush, fuzzy, generously cut, and extravagantly cabled, with a tall collar and close-fitting cuffs designed to keep warmth in. Schwartz's sweater is roughly the same color, and it is indeed a cabled sweater, but that's about where the comparison ends. Some of the differences are intentional and not necessarily bad. It's designed to fit closer to the body than Crystal's, and the detailing is more varied. But Schwartz's sweater also has an odd sheen, flat cabling and loose cuffs. It lacks the heft of Crystal's version. It looks cheaper. It was probably machine knit. Crystal's is more likely to have been handmade. This is despite the fact that, by the mass market standards of 2023, Schwartz's sweater is a nice sweater. It happens to be a Polo Ralph Lauren design that costs almost $400. As the sheer quantity of clothing available to the average American has grown over the past few decades, everything feels at least a little bit flimsier than it used to. Seams unravel after a couple of washes, garments lose their shape more quickly, shoes have to be replaced more frequently. The situation might be the worst in knitwear. Good sweaters, gloves, beanies, and scarves are all but gone from mass market retailers. The options that have replaced them lose their fluff faster, feel fake, and either keep their wearers too hot or let the winter wind whip right through them. Sometimes they even smell like plastic. The most obvious indication of these changes is printed on a garment's fiber content tag. Knits used to be made entirely from natural fibers. These fibers usually came from shearing sheep, goats, alpacas, and other animals. Sometimes plant-derived fibers, such as cotton and linen, were blended in. Now, according to Imran Islam, a textile science professor and knit expert at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, the overwhelming majority of yarn used in mass-market knitwear is blended with some type of plastic. Most commonly, this means polyester, polyamide, or acrylic. Islam and I spoke on one of the first chilly fall days in New York, and he had just finished conducting an informal test as part of a knitting lesson. He asked his students who had come to class wearing a sweater to check what it was made out of. Every sweater, he said, had some plastic in it. Knits made with synthetic fiber are cheaper to produce. They can be spun up in astronomical quantities to meet the sudden whims of clothing manufacturers. There's no waiting for whole flocks of sheep to get fluffy enough to hand shear. They also usually can be tossed in your washing machine with everything else. But by virtually every measure, synthetic fabrics are far inferior. They peel quickly, sometimes look fake, shed microplastics, and don't perform as well as wool when worn. Sweaters are functional garments, not just fashionable ones. Wool keeps its wearer warm without steaming them like a baked potato wrapped in foil. Its fibers are hygroscopic and hydrophobic, which means they draw moisture to their center and leave the surface dry. A wool sweater can absorb a lot of water from the air around it before it feels wet or cold to the touch, which goes a long way towards explaining why high-quality wool sweaters are still made in particularly damp, cold regions of the world, including Scotland and New Zealand. Some major retailers continue to carry all wool sweaters. If you're fastidious about checking tags, you're sure to find them once in a while. But don't rely on price to guide you. A significant amount of polyamide or acrylic is now common in sweaters with four-digit price tags. A $3,200 Gucci wool cardigan, for example, is actually half polyamide when you read the fine print. Cheaper materials have crept into the fashion industry's output gradually, as more and more customers have become inured to them. In the beginning, these changes were motivated primarily by the price pressures of fast fashion, Islam said. As low-end brands have created global networks that pump out extremely cheap disposable clothing, more premium brands have attempted to keep up with the frenetic pace while still maintaining profits, which means cutting costs and cutting corners. Islam estimates that a pound of sheep's wool as a raw material might cost from $1.50 to $2 per pound. A pound of cashmere might cost anywhere from $10 to $15. A pound of acrylic, meanwhile, can be had for less than $1. To make matters worse for people who just want to buy a decent sweater, Islam said that few checks and balances exist to ensure that knitwear marketed as, say, pure cashmere or merino wool actually is, unless a brand voluntarily adheres to a high standard of traceability. Retailers rarely face penalties for driving materials costs as low as possible, even if it means that sweaters don't look and feel quite as nice as they once did, and they don't need to, when almost all of your competitors are using the same sad plastic blends. No one is going to single your company out for being particularly miserly with the materials. This race to the bottom has been going on for years, but it accelerated considerably in 2005. Sophie Thonhauser, the author of Worn, A People's History of Clothing, told me. That year was the end of the multi-fiber arrangement, a trade agreement that had for three decades capped imports of textile products and yarn into the United States, Canada, and the European Union from developing countries. Once Western retailers no longer had meaningful restrictions on where they could source their garments from, many of them went shopping for the cheapest inventory possible. They found it largely in Asian and Latin American countries with few protections for garment workers or environmental regulations on the textile industry, which allowed them to slash wages and use more synthetics. That changed the unit economics of mass market fashion and of sweaters in profound ways. According to Islam, if you push down retail prices with cheap labor, they'll no longer bear the use of quality materials. If you push down retail prices with cheap materials, they'll no longer bear the wages of garment workers with more skill and experience. If you push down both as much as possible, you stand a pretty good chance of gaining market share. Either way, the conditions of the industry and the products on the shelf degrade in tandem. Knitting, in particular, is a highly skilled labor, even at its cheapest. For genuinely impressive detailing and finishing, Islam said, manufacturers need to pay up for highly experienced workers. When manufacturers forgo these costs, designs get simpler. They get boring. And when demand for that kind of skilled labor craters, those skills aren't passed on to new workers, and they eventually wash out of the labor force. The same thing happens in production of the raw materials necessary to make a better quality garment. Eventually, even if your company wants to produce something nice, durable, and well-made, your ability to do so at all, let alone at a price that anyone will pay, is greatly reduced. The majority of clothing sold in the U.S. now includes at least some plastic content. Brands generally rely on consumers not to be interested enough in fabric content to check the tags before buying. But Thonhauser said brands have also gotten more adept at marketing synthetic fibers as a consumer advantage, whether or not they actually are in any particular garment. They do enable more sweaters to be labeled as machine washable, she said, and the popularity of performance fabrics in athleisure has helped improve the public perception of all kinds of synthetic textiles, even if those materials offer few advantages outside of the athletic pursuits for which they are designed. Over time, these phenomena become self-reinforcing. Hand washing and line drying a few garments is no longer a normal part of laundry day in many homes, Thonhauser pointed out. Once the apparel market changes so much that those kind of care tasks are more of a nuisance than a necessity, people avoid garments that require them. These market changes also reflect other shifts in how people live, suspects Andre West, a former knitwear manufacturer and a professor at the North Carolina State University Wilson College of Textiles. Wool is most comfortable and effective when layered, especially for relatively affordable wool sweaters, which tend not to be super soft. Life has gotten more casual for most Americans over the past 50 years, and a button-down with a sweater on top now exceeds the expectations of many office dress codes and can feel a little formal to people more accustomed to t-shirts or polos. Indoor climate control has also gotten more sophisticated. People spend less time in drafty old buildings and more time at a constant 72 degrees. Outside, the country's temperatures are trending warmer, and more people are moving south. The end result of all of this, the changes to trade regulation, the decline in garment industry wages and working conditions, and the rise of synthetic textiles, is abundance, but only by a definition of a word that includes an abundance of junk. A good sweater is hard to find, but it's not impossible. People are still raising heritage breed sheep and spinning pure wool yarn and knitting sweaters that look and feel and perform a lot like the ones that were de rigueur a couple of generations ago. You can find them if you're fastidious about checking fiber content tags and if you pay prices that reflect the value of the materials and skill that went into their creation. That doesn't always mean paying far more than the big retailers demand for polyester blends. O'Connell's, a Buffalo, New York-based clothing store that's famous among American sweater lovers, sells a beautiful Irish-made fisherman sweater in pure wool for $198, half the price of the cheaper-looking polo blend that Schwartz appears to wear in his When Harry Met Sally reenactment. Scotland-based Jamesons of Shetland will sell you beautiful wool sweaters in the same price range, or the yarn they manufacture so you can make your own. At the very high end, Silicon Valley tech moguls obsess over four-figure Loro Piana and Brunello Cucinelli sweaters as important status symbols. For everyone else, plenty of blend garments gesture at what used to be widely available, but few hold a candle to the garments that were once the norm. And in fact, please don't get candles too close to a poly blend, which is much more likely than wool to go up in flames. Our third story today is entitled How to Break a Phone Addiction by Arthur C. Brooks. By now, nearly everyone knows we can be addicted to our digital devices. In the words of Anna Lemke, a psychiatrist and addiction specialist at Stanford, just about all of us have a digital drug of choice, and it probably involves using a smartphone, the equivalent of the hypodermic needle for a wired generation. The data suggests that Lemke's claim is not hyperbole. For example, the average smartphone user rarely goes 2 hours without using her device, unlocks her device 50 or more times a day, and swipes or taps on it as many as 2,617 times in the process. The young are particularly afflicted. A 2018 Pew Research Center report found that 44% of teens say they often check their devices for messages or notifications as soon as they wake up. 54% say they spend too much time on their mobile phone, and 42% feel anxiety when they do not have it. Those who compulsively check Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp might felt a version of this anxiety earlier this week when all the apps all vanished from the internet for a few hours. A device addiction is not innocuous. It is associated with depression and anxiety. It disproportionately victimizes lonely people. According to the technology research firm CompuCare, 26% of car accidents in the U.S. today are due to use of smartphones while driving. These problems are obvious to almost everyone. The solutions, less so. Some experts propose taxation to curb digital overuse, similar to the way the government discourages tobacco use. Others say the only way to beat an addiction is to quit cold turkey and go device-free. But in a world of electronic payments, digital documents, and remote work, a truly smartphone-free lifestyle is getting less and less practical. A better, and for more of us, a more plausible approach is to manage addictive behavior by moderating device use. This isn't just a matter of setting screen time limits that you can easily break. Rather, you can start to develop specific, concrete habits to replace the unhealthy ones that keep sending you back to your phone. In some cases, looking for the right amount of an addictive substance or activity can be perilous, and the optimal level of use is zero forever. That is the case for me with cigarettes. Quitting was one of the hardest things I'd ever done. For 3 years, I dreamed about smoking almost every night, and today I am still drawn to the smell of anything burning, whether incense or a pile of tires. But that isn't always true of addictive substances, especially in a moderation when they bring important benefits. Carbohydrates are a good example. A lot of research shows that some people tend to develop addictions to this essential macronutrient because the effects of consuming it can mimic the neurochemistry of drugs of abuse. But unlike with drugs of abuse, the right tactic with carbohydrates is definitely not to get rid of all of them. It is to eat them more responsibly and in lower quantities. The question then is whether digital devices are more like cigs or more like carbs. I believe the answer is the latter. To quit cold turkey would impose an enormous cost on virtually anyone who needs to manage a bank account, communicate with loved ones, call for a ride, work remotely, or perform countless other everyday tasks. So the proper approach is to find the right level to which we should aspire. Finding the right goal for cutting back is one thing. Actually doing it is another. Some people try therapy, and psychologists have even recommended drugs to help treat-related dependencies such as internet addiction. But for those wishing to find a do-it-yourself approach, here are three practices you might find effective. 1. Make time for scrolling. This may sound counterintuitive, but bear with me. A good deal of the device overuse can be blamed on the mindlessness of it. One 2018 study of Australian adults found that 86% admitted to using their smartphones automatically. You know what I mean. If you have 15 seconds of downtime in an elevator or waiting at a red light, out pops your phone. You might not even realize you're looking at it. You are basically just killing time. The best way to counteract mindless scrolling is with mindful scrolling. Set times each day or week to look at your smartphone and really focus on it. Don't do anything else. Be all about the phone for those minutes as if it were your job. Adapt the Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh's instructions in The Miracle of Mindfulness. While washing the dishes, one should only be washing the dishes, which means that while washing the dishes, one should be completely aware of the fact that one is washing the dishes. Besides making addiction easier to beat, studies have found mindfulness to be very effective in treating addictions. Such a practice might also show you how little you actually enjoy staring at your phone. 2. Turn off your notifications. Most addictions are associated with a neurotransmitter called dopamine. It governs desire and spikes when we get environmental cues, such as advertisements and reminders to do something pleasurable, like smoke or gamble or check our phone. The solution is simple. If you have a smartphone, turn off all the notifications, except perhaps the ones you need to stay employed, and the ringer for when your mother calls. 3. Physically separate yourself. If you're trying to eat healthier, a common piece of advice you might hear from a nutritionist is avoid having junk food in the house. The idea is that unhealthy eating, a choice you might otherwise make without thinking, should require effort. The same idea applies to the phone. Some people take this advice even further. The digital technology expert Cal Newport advocates a phone foyer method, wherein he leaves his phone by the front door when he walks into his house and doesn't put it in his pocket until he leaves again. If he needs to look at it, he only does so in the foyer. I'm sorry I had to cut that last article short, as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind.